This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thank you, Margot, very much. It really is not just a pleasure to be invited, but it is an honour to speak at this great institution. I'm really sorry I couldn't be here yesterday, but I was in fact teaching at the University of Sydney, and that was the wrap-up session for my seminar there. So those students had first call on my time, and I was very sorry not to be here to hear the papers of my colleagues who work in the field of Aboriginal art studies and have done so effectively for so long. So my apologies to them. The third thing to say is it really is a privilege to be here, and the privilege occurred to all of us when we were in the room next door. I was thinking about some of the great exhibitions that I've seen, and I have been lucky enough to, for example, go around the Jackson Pollock retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art about 10 years ago by myself for some reason that was arranged, and that's something I'll never forget. And similarly with Robert Ryman. When you do that, you have a chance to see everything that is wonderful and the greatest achievements of an artist, and also you can see the parts that are not working or where the wheels fall off, and so which we can see next door. So we see Emily in an extraordinary depth and range, and the spotting, I really love the spotlighting, because it's very calm spotlighting compared to the Papunya Tula show as installed currently in Sydney, which has wonderful work. But I took friends from the United States around who had not seen this work before, and their main comment was, this is so intense. All these works are similarly intense. What's the intensity? Where does that come from? And unfortunately, mostly came from the lighting as opposed to the work. So somehow we had to, because it was uniform lighting, we had to work through that to get to the real intensity of that. That works. And the collection, the Papunya collection from here is a staggering collection. But there are other ones that are great. Okay, those three things said, I'm not so much going to talk about Emily as an internationalist as such, because she wasn't. That's just a shorthand that's not going to work in the context. The situation is in fact more complex, I think, and more interesting. And one way of bringing that to your attention is to start from, in a sense, the biggest picture, not just Australia and the rest of the world, not just the desert, Utopia, and Alice Springs, etc., etc., but the very largest picture. And the thinking I'm doing now about the nature of contemporary life and what I call the condition of contemporaneity is really influenced a lot by big picture history. In fact, by the opposite, trying to think back through human history through time and the ways in which that's possible to do. One of the outstanding practitioners of this idea of big history is David Christian, who, of course, is an Australian. From Melbourne and then Sydney, now in San Diego. And he's leading a sort of pushover in the States to develop world history as a subject in the high schools in particular. And he's written a book, of which this is image comes from, for high school teachers on how to teach world history, which is in 1 year teach the entire history of humans on the planet with all the implications involved. And, of course, it's can be a very general enterprise, and it can be full of generalisations that don't hold totally. But the question is, and this is really important for our thinking about, say, Emily and modernism and such questions, certain generalisations of a certain kind can hold at the appropriate level. If you shift them down to, say, a more regional level, they won't hold. You shift them to a local level, they won't hold. To a personal level, they won't hold. But there are, in other words, there are ways of answering the questions that come up that need to be calibrated to, as it were, the level on which they're properly asked and the level on which the work itself is done and where it's circulating. It's not a random business, just that we need to be a bit more precise about it. So that's partly what I'll try and do today, to suggest a framework for doing that in the case of looking at Emily's work. So when you look at a diagram, you look at it long enough now to see that he has the idea that human history obviously moves through time, through these eras, as opposed to the 19th century, where a diagram like this would have been the other way around, implying that there was a primitive race of people at the bottom and we've progressed from there upwards. Now you've got to really try and imagine this going along horizontally through time, and it's laid out in the other way because of convenience. But you have these eras, each one of which succeeds the other, foraging, agrarian and modern, and there's subsidiary eras, subordinate eras within them. And a couple of things stand out immediately, which is that the contemporary era, which is really a small section of which we're talking about, Emily's life is, time obviously goes through the modern period, but she's in the contemporary era like all of us from this very broad point of view, which itself is within modernity as an era. Clearly the assumption here is that human history on the planet has moved from the top to the bottom and is continually modernising. It's devoted above all to it's driven in the point of view of people like David Christian by relatively rational responses to living conditions and the numbers of people who have to deal with the resources that are available, and that can be elaborated in all kinds of ways, but that's the sort of fundamental driver, which of course is a concept that makes a lot of sense in the modern era. So it's a modern concept that's read back through history and brought forward. One of the distinguishing features of modernity, according to him, is the inevitable erasure of foraging cultures and foraging values. The fact that people whose worldviews and approaches to life and beliefs and so on were developed in that first era still exist in this era is itself remarkable from that point of view. What he sees as a long-term trend against their survival and their anachronism is profound. So on a model like this, there's built into it an assumption that what happens in the room next door simply couldn't happen, shouldn't happen, and if it did happen, something is really weird and peculiar and against the grain of history about it. So that tells us that this way of looking at the world has a profound inadequacy built into it. It's obvious that indigenous peoples throughout the world, in fact, are struggling in enormous ways, in ways we know. But there's also has been for now a number of decades a turn towards growth in many ways. And there's also been the production of culture and art around that concept, and that's also what we see next door. Because if we see anything, we see imagery again and again about what it is to in fact grow and see that which grows, see the earth growing in all kinds of ways and bodies and people growing from conditions of enormous scarcity. They look like they're scarcity from this point of view, but not from other points of view. So this kind of art is sort of speaking back against this massive presumption in Western historical thinking, out of which questions like, is this modern or not, come. So what I'm trying to say straight up is that notions of fitting Emily into modern or contemporary or terms like that really have to be thought about in a way that reminds us that these terms are incredibly loaded. They have enormous historical force and weight to them. So that's a first point. That's not to say they're wrong. That's not to say they don't have power, because they absolutely do. It's to say that we have to think up a richer way of working with them and working against their over-presumptions. Now, for the next few minutes, I'm going to do a little bit of, basically classroom instruction. So forgive me if it's too obvious for you, but I just want to look at the concept of the contemporary We could do something similar for the term modern. And what I really want to do is, and this is crucial to a lot of the work I'm doing now, is draw your attention to the fact that this is a term that has a huge history also in human usage in many different languages. I would love to know and have the ability to know how concepts like the contemporary or similar to the contemporary work in various Aboriginal languages, Indigenous languages. I don't know that. But I have looked in a little bit into how it works in English and related European languages. And the first thing we realise about it is that it means a hell of a lot more than what we people normally speak English now take it to mean. We normally take it to mean that which is happening now, whatever's occurring, or what's up to date maybe is a bit more loaded. And we use it as a kind of placeholder term. We say, okay, that's contemporary, and we kind of, as it were, then wait for further definition. We're often waiting for it to become modern so we can fit it into a modern framework and understand it. But we also think a lot about our art that way often. It's contemporary. We're waiting to see which of it will connect with previous art, become modern, connect with the history of art. The rest will just go away. So the presumption about contemporary is, yes, it's here, but most of it's going to go. Now, once you start thinking about it like that, you realise that contempus means what it means. It means not just time now. It means to be with time. It means all the ways in which one can be with time. An object can exist in time. A person can live through time. And as you'll see, live through time with others. So the contemporary is about multiple temporalities, multiple experiences of time occurring at the same time or maybe occurring at in the past. So, of course, past contemporaries are really important too. Let me take you just through the normal list of dictionary definitions. Belonging to the same time, age or period. To belong to a period can either mean you just happen to live in it, but to belong to it is really important. The ways in which our time now, all that which we all share, whatever we differences we have, the way that bears on us creates conditions of belonging which we can sometimes choose, sometimes not choose to pursue. So belonging is a very powerful way of being in time, relating to time. People often speak about our time or their time. That's already, that's to speak about what's shared, and there's a lot that's shared. No matter what else is different, there's a lot to share. Having existed, this is just a very fairly straightforward way of being in the same time period or same time zone, to be coeval. To occur at the same time is like adventitious. It happens this way. As an event, there's one event, another event that happens at the same time. But already we've got three different ways of being in time. They're really important. The fourth one is in the dictionary is, of course, modern. So modern in the orthodox sense. So, in fact, in usage, and particularly in the art world, contemporary has replaced modern and did so during the 1990s. There's a whole history of that. Took over the word modern. The word modern disappeared. Postmodern's disappeared. Contemporary is just a default word where people don't think much about what's going on. One really other important thing to say, and again we see it, and we're very aware of it in this country, in a very general sense, Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples have a profoundly different sense of what time is, how it moves through its own histories, what it is for a body to be in time, what it is for memory to work, profoundly different. I'm sure you spoke about it yesterday. But again, it's not all white people have one sense of time. All Indigenous people have another sense of time. Here's one, here's another. And they're the same for both parties. That's obviously a nonsense. There's multiple ways of being in time in both both cultural spheres, and there are multiple ways of existing in time between those spheres because they are contemporaneous with each other. And this is the other crucial thing. When you look at those definitions, they apply to everybody to varying degrees, and they could apply. But what they highlight is that we are in the world with others, And being in time and place, being in time and place with others is absolutely crucial. So those two things are kind of pivotal to background thinking to the issue that we're dealing with. Which leads me to have developed a diagram like this, which I'll spend another few minutes going through, and then I'll actually start looking at Emily's work and relating all this to these issues. This is the kind of structure I'm using at the moment to write the books I'm doing. And it's a proposition about the ways in which contemporary art has come to be in what I call the conditions of contemporaneity. So I think we've moved beyond being in human periods, epochs and eras. So this is where I really disagree with David Christian. We've moved beyond modernity, post-modernity. I think we've moved to a point where the different ways of being in the world at present have generated such profound incommensurabilities between perceptions of the world and understandings of the future, readings of the past and so on. They're not infinite, they're in profound blocks and profound different configurations, many of which are actually at war with each other at the moment and generating all kinds of conflicts in the world, as well as huge movements to negotiate and develop a kind of peaceful coexistence between them. So we've got those kind of huge things occurring. But what that adds up to, in my view, is that we've brought ourselves to a kind of condition or a state of being which doesn't have the overall shape and form of a human era. It's not necessarily moving forward in time in a way that's continuous with past time. Elements of it are, many elements are, but some aren't. So we've got the coexistence, when we look at art, of developments that are up the top there, quite consistent and traditional with the development of art, particularly in the West, incorporating art from elsewhere. As you see, contemporary art in the normal sense as an artistic style. When we look at the work of artists such as Damien Hirst, for example, we realise we're looking at an artist who works with the image, creating sensations with his work, is a sensationalist promoter of his work. Artists like Jeff Koons and so on, we have that obvious focus on artworks that operate as part of the high market and work literally as instant visual sensations in and of themselves. That's one very obvious tendency in contemporary art, quite consistent with developments in modernism, particularly avant-garde practice throughout the 20th century. Similarly, we have what I call re-modernism, which is a repeat, reversion to, recurrence. It's a reshaping and renovating, making new modernist art practices, modernist traditions, and doing and using anything to do that. So artists such as Richard Serra, Gerhard Richter, Sean Scully's work, people like that I'll show you, are re-modernists. But they're the sort of main tendencies operating around the world. But for the past 30 or 40 years, as a result of decolonisation, vastly different ways of making art, thinking about visual images, relating to mediums and communicating values have appeared. The Aboriginal art movement itself, in a sense, is an emergence along that second stream that I'm talking about. It's moved from creating kind of nationalist, national arts, and again, in a very particular way, insofar as the Aboriginal art movement in this country is a movement, I think, it's a national movement. In other words, it attempts to create some connections between Aboriginal cultures within the nation of Australia. It gets, as Ian has pointed out to us, taken over and absorbed into the non-Indigenous image of the governmental image of Australia, the official state image of Australia. But in many ways, it's about nationalities and local, very local cultural formations and making them alive and keeping them alive and making their presence felt and giving them an imagery, an existence in the world of images, I would argue. But that, of course, connects back with the rest of the world because this has happened, this is the South rethinking the North as things have evolved. And so that's very mobile across the world. And that's created the conditions you see down the kind of art you see down the bottom, which is really art more of a younger generation, particularly a younger generation than Emily's generation, where artists are more concerned with very specific questions of time and place and media and mood in this sort of way. Work on a much lower key scale and produce works of art that try to seek a way beyond the kind of north-south conflict that in effect is embodied in the two top tendencies. So I see these as currents of contemporary art working around the world. The point about them is that they actually coexist, they operate in parallel with each other, and often, and this is really important in the case we're discussing, artists, being aware of this, try and work between them or across them. And like all artists, they often work against the grain of a larger tendency. So I think that's the picture. I mean, it usually takes me... it's taken me a 100,000-word book to lay out at the moment, so I won't go into any more detail, but just so you know where I'm coming from, because the main message I'm wanting to convey to you is that when we tackle these questions about the nature of art of someone like Emily, which is made in a community and then sent out from it, however much she turns her back, she's actually sending something out about her own life and her own values in ways that she has come to understand will be grasped by people who have a different way of looking at images and understanding art and so on than she might have had earlier on, or the people immediately around her might have. So my point there is she's alert to what's going out and its possible effects on the basis of reports back to her about those effects. So there are these divisions, but I'm also arguing that certain artists act between them, and it's parallel to what happens on the level of politics and so on. Okay, so that leads us to the question. Is Emily's art contemporary according to this broad view, and if so, how? How might it be contemporary? And what I've clearly made you aware of, I hope, is that the answer to that is going to be multiple. There's going to be at least two or three answers, not one. So searching for one quality of Emily that's going to really give the answer to understanding her work is as false about her as it is about any artist in the condition of contemporaneity. It's not going to fly to think like that anymore. That's a modern way of thinking about these issues. Things are more complex now. Okay, now, in terms of works, to show you, I haven't got a work that's anywhere near as good as what's in the exhibition, but some of these are a little close. So I'm just going to show you a couple of works and make some comparisons to bring out this idea of work being made by her and then work being made by others. Other artists totally working in a different part of that diagram, if you like, for different purposes. So just to evoke something that operates in Emily's earlier work, the business of making a painting initially based on sacred body markings for emu and for kame, for seed, a work such as this can evoke that in our minds, and there's a great wall of seed paintings in the show there. And I like the idea of seeding because that's one I hadn't thought of before. But initially we used to think about these works as underpainting and then overpainting. So the overpainting practice was understood to be a practice of obscuring that which was sacred about the work. But, you know, what the show tells us and what's become obvious when we think about her work more generally is that that's the parallel drawn from Jackson Pollock's way of underpainting and then overpainting his imagery. The under-imagery in Jackson Pollock usually is a really profoundly psychic disturbance he had with his mother and images of carving her up with a knife and, I mean, all sorts of deeply psychotic things that he tended to draw initially in his paintings and then, finding them unbearable, draw lines from them and paint over them. And he did this for nearly all his career except for about 2 years in 19, 49 and 1950, 48, 49, 50. And even then he did it during that period, except for about five paintings. And that becomes obvious when you really look at his paintings closely. But that practice of putting something down that's intensely important and then disappearing it is obviously to a degree important for many Aboriginal artists. But what we learned from the show is that that's one movement, present it, another movement, cover it. But if you have the imagery of seeding, you have an imagery of the painting, as it were, itself exploding seeds out at you. And that happens so often in this exhibition, it's quite extraordinary. And so we thank Margot for bringing that out for us. So there you have an artwork that moves one step, two step, three, moves like that towards the spectator, which if you start to think about it is a lot to do with, finding something in the ground, helping it grow, and then drawing it out of the ground. So it's clearly, obviously a very specific practice relating to yam itself and gathering and yam seeding and so on. So you've also clearly got in her paintings an imagining, which I'll underline in the next example, an imagining of what it is for the body to, as it were, be the earth. You know, in other words, what it is for a person to be land, to be country as such. That's the most profound imagining that goes on in her work and the work of many other Aboriginal artists. In her case, I think it's a very rich one, but I'll come to the ways in which I see it in a minute. First point, let me do a comparison. So if you compare these two, this is a work by Gerhard Richter, Corn, it's not about seeding as such, but it's about a place, but the title. Now, Richter is a great artist in what we call a post-conceptual, post-photography painter. So for him to paint during the 80s was to paint after painting itself in the Western tradition was meant to have finished, to be over, to be complete, to have arrived at the total black painting, minimal sculpture, end of art practice based on the old studio traditions of painting or sculpture or architecture and graphic design and so on. So in that context, the only kind of painting you could do in the West was a sort of, and this is a standard interpretation of his work, which is, I think, mostly accurate, although he denies it himself, the only kind of painting you can do is painting that in one way or other mourns the death of painting, evokes the idea of the artificiality of painting, but quotes past works of art such as abstract expressionist work. And the whole procedure in the case of Richter is that he takes a photograph or creates a computer-simulated model, like of an abstract form or something, paints that up, and then actually applies this great squeegees, pulls that image off and blurs that image, then paints over it again and blurs that. So he's applying kind of silk screening like Warhol and photographic printing techniques to painting and trying to capture them in oil paint. So it's really art about art about art not being able to be painting. Now, none of this is relevant to Emily. Those set of concerns utterly coincidental in terms of the look of the work. It's just a totally different mindset about the same subject. So that's the level on which these artists are extremely different. There's another level, however, on which they share something, although it's a parallel. It's not the same thing, it's a parallel. In many of Richter's paintings, and people are now realising this more and more, he's a German romantic, and his work continues very much from the exhibition you would have seen here of landscape painting in the gallery, from Friedrich onwards. This is a painting called January. It's not called January for no reason. He just didn't happen to paint it in January. It's a painting that, using that technique that I've spoken about, still evokes what it is to be in southern Germany in winter, to evoke the nature of the soil, of really dirty snow, without picturing it, just evoking that kind of setting. And many of you will know that Richter also does photographically realist paintings of such settings alongside these very abstract ones. And he paints abstract images over photographs of such settings. So he actually is an artist who's, in the German Romantic tradition, very aware of natural phenomena and development of the seasons in his own area. So he's a quasi-regionalist artist, despite the usual interpretations. So that's a parallel to what Emily's doing. It's not the same thing, it's a parallel. And it's done with a whole different way, as I've just demonstrated, of thinking about painting. So if we come to a work such as this Desert Storm, and this is not a complete image of it, unfortunately the image I could get has cropped off about 2 or 2 foot 6 from either end. So what you've got to imagine is that at either end of this painting, the implied flowers blossom and become greener up that end and yellower up this end. This, of course, is a very large picture and painted in 1992. It's painted at the time of the Desert Storm invasion of Iraq, but has nothing at all to do with that. It is about a storm in the desert. It's about a wet. It's about a wet in the desert. To me, it kind of... I wrote about this in a book edited by Jenny Isaac, so if you want the full account, please go and refer to that. But this is a painting which I think, like many in the show, particularly the works that are... the works that sort of head in from the one owned by Anne Lewis and turn into the room behind, like the Potato Dreaming ones. These works are absolutely extraordinary to me because what they do is evoke that idea of the body is the land in a very concrete and specific way. Because what you're looking at, in effect, is on one level, a depiction of a lot of water coming in during a storm in the desert, turning the red sand into this blurry stuff, moving in towards the centre, making a kind of gully, if you like, collecting the water, creating, in effect, what is a soakage bore, which will go down and then come out later on. So this is a work in which, in a certain sense, her entire region, or what's fundamental about the movement of water in that region, is depicted as moving in and flowing in. And then, as I said, if you could see the whole painting, I'm sorry you can't, at either end the thing, water comes out and all these wildflowers kind of appear. In terms of the body, sense of body is involved. The body that's involved here, I think, is profoundly female body. This is profoundly... many of the paintings I don't think could have been painted by males. I think it's a profoundly female sense of what it is to have a body that's created in these works, not just because of the markings, but because of, you know, the sense of implied flesh, even though it's sort of land that's also being painted, that's here. And that's a lot to do with, again, the fact that the paintings after paintings open up at their centre. This sounds corny, but it is, in fact, something that I directly experienced, I'm sure many people do. Their paintings are sort of open fissures. They kind of draw you in as fissures. And then they kind of grow out again or reach out again. So how's that done? I think it's quite literally done by her technique of painting, which, as you know, is most of the paintings were actually on stretches, or if not, they were. And she draws them to her lap, and she tended to paint out in a series of lines and then paint back in a series of others. So her action of painting is a kind of reaching out to the extent that she can reach and then drawing what she's done back into herself. And every single line there is done that way, or done this way and done this way. So the parallel to Pollock, you know, who painted by doing this flicking while drawing and then much more free-floating, there's a parallel, but it's very different. That's, again, a very masculine way of thinking about it. Conquering space, whereas here it's quite different. So in my view, these have all amounted to a fundamentally different way of generating artistic form, and that that's, you know, in a certain way it's the achievement which she sends back as it were, from the desert, from that second post-colonial movement that I delineated, to the first one. That's what she sends back to world contemporary art. So that's the way in which her art is international, right? Not because it looks like other international art, but because it's got something to say, something absolutely profoundly original to say about what it is to make a painting of such important topics, to say that back to the ways in which artists in the West and the North have done that for centuries. Okay, now, a few more parallels to show you that that's also done by artists working from the North according to their own framework. And this is the case of Sean Scully, the great Irish artist, who paints walls. I mean, this is not, he's not painting the land or the land as body. There's nothing to do with that. This is about what it is to look at a wall and a wall to communicate to you and convey its character to you. And I chose one where he's looking at the wall in the desert at night time. A parallel sort of subject to Emily, but I'm not knowledgeable enough to distinguish the works she did of night, night in the desert as opposed from the day. Did she do any night pictures? Do we know that? No, I don't think so. So, but you know, he clearly is, and you've got to think about light movement in the night. You've got to think about walls in desert, in the desert, probably North Africa and places such as that. So it's a different kind of perspective. It's kind of more, a little more tourist, a little more thinking about the history of walls and constructed architecture in that sense. Whereas, again, to my knowledge, I don't think Emily has painted a structure, a built structure as such. Do we know that? No.
Has she painted
a built structure?
I think she's painted television screens
and cardboard. Oh, no, not onto them, but painted, used them as imagery. Has she? No, okay. So it's fine. It's a different register. It's just different things that are really important. But natural effects to a northern artist are things like light on wall. It's a different way of understanding how natural effect operates. And that makes sense if... But that's all other subject. The history of architecture is different in that way. It is really... It's about... No, I won't go there. All right. So, now, just two more general points, and then I'll sum up. Is that okay? Can I do a bit more? Okay, great. I will. Okay, thank you. In the face, okay. All right. So I'm making points so far about the way in which her work emerges from its own conditions, is absolutely particular and specific to not just her conditions, but obviously her as an individual artist, in those conditions. And this is where people then suddenly start talking about genius and so on. Usually people use the word genius when they have run out of explanations. You just can't explain it anymore. And that's okay. But what's more important here is that we're not trying to look for explanations that are produced by the circumstances, such that anyone in those circumstances will make this art no matter what. That's not... I'm trying to look at how circumstances are responded to by an individual, one specific individual, and then the other ones, like the ones I'm showing you. And so that is present. That individuality is present. We're not generalising about Aboriginal art in general here. Because clearly, you know, if you understand her achievement in the depth that I'm trying to do and my colleagues are, its individual character should be coming out. A similar kind of analysis should be able to be done for at least a number of other artists as well. Not everybody, because not everybody is that profoundly original or has that profound grasp of fundamental things. Okay, so I want to shift now to the other idea of contemporaneity that I mentioned earlier, the idea of the world clash of different cultures. How does her work and how does the work of other Aboriginal artists operate in that framework? In which ways is it contemporary? And I'll just quickly go through that because we, in a way, are going beyond Emily before coming back to her, but just as a kind of parallel and contrast. Turki Tolson Jupurulu, I mean, a series of absolutely wonderful and very important works done during the 90s and up to his death in 2002, I think. Straightening Spears, the one from Adelaide, there are a number of others. Great major paintings, as you know, based on the story of the initial possibility of conflict between groups of men, which was resolved by the elders focusing for so long and so carefully on getting their spears straightened and ready over the fire for the conflict, that the conflict never occurred, didn't happen. And just, there's a lot more to it, but the essence of that story is that, again, it's a story about, you know, difference and war and destruction, but it's possible ways of resolving it. So these are paintings about peace, about how to generate a condition of peace. That's absolutely at one with the country that you're in, while recognising the potential for conflict within it. And that, again, is worked out as a practice of painting. Careful dots, lining them up over time in this kind of mesmeric state, with all the different colours evoking both the bodies of people, the sand, the sun, fire, land, the ash of the ashes, the actual spears themselves implied in some of the shapes left over, but also in some of the white lines. So again, the painterly practice and the subject are deeply integrated. One comes out of the other. It's interesting. That's, in fact, the key value of how to judge a really good work of modernist painting, as it turns out. Right? That the profound content of the work is expressed above all through the form and the process through which the work was done. That's the ethical fallout of modernism in art. And there's a parallel thing going on clearly in the way that I look at the work of these artists, and that could be to do with my own history and training and limitations, but maybe not. In a work such as this, and here we get into some strange territory, this was done in by Turkey Tolson in the year 2000, and I think that maybe that was when he died, 2000. It's one of his monoprints that Christopher Hodges actually was kind enough to let me buy from him, two sites, and it's clearly two sacred sites, and I took it with me to the States, where I arrived on September the 10th, 2001, and I'm looking at this image and I'm looking at the towers and I'm thinking, Jesus, what is going on here? What's happening? So I leave that in your own unconsciousnesses. The general point is that, in a certain way, I already had his gift, which was the gift of thinking about the possibilities of peace, even in such circumstances. Other artists responded, or other people responded to this situation very differently, and you know that Gordon Bennett, again, he's written wonderfully about this work, did a series of images where he himself already, in dialogue with Jean-Michel Basquiat, who was, of course, dead by then, but the spirit of Jean-Michel Basquiat, as an alter ego, in a sense, to him, Gordon, as an artist. So in various works, in dialogue with him, part of his response was to be shocked back to some of his early works. The Coming of the Light is an early work by Gordon Bennett, being quoted up the top there on the left, where the Statue of Liberty and the chain, the convict chain or chain of death is connected, which he's doing in terms of the attacks on the towers and, again, the impact on bodies. He's clearly seen the buildings as bodies. I mean, he's got an analysis that took a lot of us a long time to get to. In fact, in a curious way, I should have put this on the cover of my book, Architecture of Aftermath, rather than, I suppose, the photograph of the towers going down. Because really, most of it's there. in the middle of it, he also has his, by out of interest, his series of words that he uses that he's not really happy about, the way in which definitions like the ones I offer all the time are not necessarily such a great thing to see for artists to have to contemplate. And it's always interesting, has modern, contemporary, current, fashionable, and so on and so forth. And it goes along this great list of terms that, in his case, are not getting anywhere. But I hope in my analyses they're a little richer. So that's one kind of response by Amuri, Australian artist. Others' responses to 9/11 were different depending on where the artist came from. Paul Chan did these wonderful works which simply showed things in the world rising slowly up out of Manhattan upwards, as if they were being resurrected or turned into, the rapture had happened in really some weird way. So again, these are people trying to understand the presence of the spirituals in the secular, and spiritual belief being acted upon and made secular, which in a certain sense the attacks did that. So issues like that are very important in the connections between those different levels of our culture, our contemporary culture. So I'll just wrap up with this work. Just a work of an artist, and not Emily, because, you know, Emily, as you know, is no longer with us, but a very much younger generation Aboriginal artist who is trying to do work that addresses these questions and tries to think on a similar level, but not on such an epic scale. So Rosie Namok, she's got a work here, Before Time, Proper Strong. And the imagery that operates here is drawn not only from her, her local culture and local ways of thinking, but also clearly she must have been told about the creation of the universe and looked at the Christian story, which you see in the Sistine Chapel, dividing the light from the dark. So Before Time, this is a very powerful image of the world coming into being, being created, that really, I think, parallels the Genesis imagery of it, but again is very different. And I was going to compare it to a Richter, where he does that blur that I mentioned before, just to point out that she's obviously looked at the Richter but is not doing what he's doing. She's doing something more like this, and this is in a way a kind of tribute back, not directly to Emily, but to women such as Emily. A Queensland artist to use surfboards like Scott Redford, but take the Scott Redford surfboard and put it to work in terms of reminding people of the value of remembering country and the character of country, is again a very contemporary thing to do, but contemporary in a different way from what we've seen. So, sorry to go on for so long, but what I've tried to sketch out for you ways of thinking about what it is to be contemporary in the present, to underline the fact that it's not to have just an up-to-date style or to look like contemporary artists elsewhere, but profoundly, it's to give to people the gift of a sense of what it is to be in the complex times in which we live, and what it is to try and live and exist in a world in which cultures are pulling in different directions and have different senses of time. And the great gift of Next Door is that we have someone who's given us a way of, really profound levels, moving our emotions and our feelings between these complexities. So thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.